Hi, everyone, and welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Sophia Simonello.
And I'm Nick Rurkraut.
And today we are doing a little Oscar Rewind anniversary episode. We are celebrating On the Waterfront at 70. It's a major winner at the Oscars, directed by Elia Kazan, I think known for Marlon Brando's performance, Eva Marie Saint's film debut. And I'm excited to talk about this one today. I think despite the fact that it is considered one of the all-time great classic Hollywood films, it's not one that I've revisited as frequently as some of the other films that we've talked about. And there's a rich history to it, especially around Elia Kazan and his activities with HUAC, or the House Committee on Un-American Activities. A lot to get into with the movie itself, the direction, and of course, how well it did at the Oscars. So it'll be a good conversation.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest Oscar winners that we haven't covered yet. So I am excited to talk about it in that respect. Elia Kazan, very central to this conversation today and how we frame and look at this movie. But I think his films, if we look at the 50s, are defining of that decade. And this movie, because of its structure and its amazing performances, Strasberg, method acting, all of that has to do with why it did so well with audiences and critics. I think leading up to this podcast, I rewatched it again. I had watched it earlier this year, finishing my Best Picture Winners marathon. I wasn't as high on it then, but I rewatched it again to be able to talk about it a little bit better today. And it did fare better. I will say that. I think after four watches that I've seen this.
Oh, no.
Ever. I appreciate it. I understand its importance, especially in 1954 when the percentage of workers in labor unions was at its highest in America, which is definitely important to this. It's funny looking back at history. I think this is a movie in particular where you have to look at the time and what was going on. Certain studios didn't want to touch this movie. Zanuck was like, hell no. And Spiegel with Columbia ended up picking it up. And it's kind of surprising that it was that way because, again, Zanuck was like, no one cares about labor unions, which is a crazy statement to say then. But it's a movie that has impacted not only cinema, but I think how we view unions and just the solidarity and workers in general. So I do appreciate what this movie did really for America and that it has had a lasting impact on Hollywood.
Well, I'm sorry that you had to revisit it so many times. It is one, though, that I think is, I had actually not rewatched it since high school. So this is one, like I said at the top, that, you know, of all of the Best Picture winners, I know deep down that it's one of the great ones, but it's just not one that I find myself really being a champion of. I think my Elia Kazan movie really is Streetcar Named Desire, but the things that I love about that film, I did find myself appreciating here. I really love Eva Marie Saint's performance, and I think what Marlon Brando is doing is spectacular. And if you read what critics at the time were saying and what other filmmakers are saying about his performance, you do start to believe it a little bit. And I know we'll talk about the performance itself, but Elia Kazan, he said, quote, that this is the finest thing ever done by an American film actor. Do you think that it's top tier? Do you think it's one of the great all-time best actor wins in performances?
I think for Brando finally winning, maybe in winning performances, I would say yes, because it's a little more understated than his work in Streetcar, which I think I like more if we're looking at his performances. But I don't know, best of all time is also things I try to stay away from saying. I didn't have like a really big emotional connection to any of the performances. I think maybe most of all would have been Father Barry with Carl Malden. I liked him, but again, I think audiences and critics championed their own favorites throughout the season. And because there are so many, I mean, we have a lot of Oscar records with this movie we can mention later too, but I think that speaks to people identifying with certain characters in the story differently.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel about the acting, I guess, in general?
The acting is what I like about this movie. Like, that is really the crown jewel, right? It's these people coming from the actor's studio. It's the Elia Kazan method, literally the method, right? And the performances are so realistic. And that's what I love about it. It's so different from what we were also seeing at the time. This is my favorite Marlon Brando performance and probably the top 10% of my list for best actor. I need to do a best actor ranking. But off the top of my head, it's pretty high up there. I do think it's his best performance in his career. And I also wouldn't have given him the win, The Streetcar Year. That's Monty Clift for me for A Place in the Sun, of course. But I did like what you were saying also about the studio system and people not wanting to touch this. And I think that's also because, you know, at the time, not only are they saying, you know, who cares about workers, who cares about unions? This was the era of the big, jazzy, bright studio musical and people wanting to go to the cinema to escape what was happening in their real life. And something like On the Waterfront, this kind of grimy, gritty film about workers, right? Like that's a completely different thing than what the studio system thought audiences would want. But also these studios were looking for their big Oscar movie at the same time. So the fact that On the Waterfront could be that, right? Like they wanted the next Grapes of Wrath. And in many ways, like On the Waterfront does fit that bill because, like we're going to talk about, it won 8 Oscars. So this film is really interesting, I think, just as a work of art itself, but also just given the historical context, which a lot of this I had completely forgotten about or didn't know until I had started digging a little bit deeper. So let's get into it. Description here. Terry Malloy dreams about being a prize fighter while tending his pigeons and running errands at the docks for Johnny Friendly, the corrupt boss of the Dockers Union. Terry witnesses a murder by 2 of Johnny's thugs and later meets the dead man's sister and feels responsible for his death. She introduces him to Father Barry, who tries to force him to provide information for the courts that will smash the dock racketeers. This was directed by Elia Kazan and stars Marlon Brando, Eva Marie Saint, Carl Malden, Lee J. Cobb, and Rod Steiger. This won 8 Oscars for Picture, Director, Actor for Brando, Supporting Actress for Eva Marie Saint, Story and Screenplay, Art Direction Black and White, Cinematography Black and White, and Film Editing. It also had 4 other nominations. We had 3 people nominated for Supporting Actor, Lee J. Cobb, Carl Malden, and Rod Steiger, and then Leonard Bernstein, Maestro himself, was nominated for Score. I love the score. It's great.
The score is fantastic, and that was part of what was also revolutionary about this movie is how he composed it versus those jazzy musical films that we have post-World War II that are defining of a new era for the country. So Bernstein really put his own spin on this. He introduces all of these lovely themes in the beginning and starts the movie out not how you would expect, not like these big musical numbers that audiences had seen for years at this point. And the fact that this is Bernstein's only film score that isn't tied to songs or a musical. So I think in that regard, it's special. I definitely appreciated it throughout the movie, I think the most out of its components. But once I saw his name in those opening credits, I also was like, oh my God, during Maestro, we had that interview about On the Waterfront. So it brought back that from last season covering that movie and Bradley Cooper, obviously.
Yeah. When you see Leonard Bernstein's name in the opening credits, it is really exciting because you know the score is going to be excellent, but also very different, right, for a movie like this. And I think it does make sense when you consider Elia Kazan's background in the theater and these actors, you know, being from the stage. So I feel it does feel like a nice partnership there. I think that what Kazan is doing with the camera throughout the film, those are things that are really unique. There are some moments where they'll play with the sound in particular, or he will slow things down or speed things up. And I feel like that work is taking the film to another height, right? It's not just like you're filming a stage adaptation. Like we talked about a little bit with Streetcar, how his direction transcended that of being just a filmed stage play. It was more than that. And I think he does the same thing here. But this, of course, isn't based on a play. It's based on a series of articles called Crime on the Waterfront by Malcolm Johnson. And then the story itself was written by Bud Schulberg, who was Kazan, one of his greatest, I would say, collaborators throughout the process. So it's really, I think, again, when we think about story and screenplay as an Oscar, it's inspired by that Malcolm Johnson work from the New York Sun, which ended up actually winning the Pulitzer. But it's based on a lot of the work that Schulberg did, interviewing people who lived in New Jersey, these longshoremen who were victims of all of the widespread corruption that was going on. So I feel like the screenplay is one of the highlights, but there was also a lot of drama behind the scenes. Maybe we can talk about that before we get into how we felt about individual scenes in the film itself, because a lot of people were very unhappy. Actors, real people that this was based on, other directors who are friends with Kazan. So what did you find anything in particular in your research that made you gasp, I'll say, or that you found more exciting than the movie itself?
There is a lot of backstory to consider here, and a lot of people discredit this movie because of what it means in terms of Kazan's career and what he did previously. So I think we do need to mention this first. If you haven't seen the movie and you don't want this to distort your view of it, then maybe watch that and come back to this. I don't know if it would have affected me. I mean, I did watch it before knowing this, but it is really important. So like you mentioned earlier, he was involved with HUAC. So he testified to this committee because he had been a part of the Communist Party years ago, I believe during the 30s. But he ended up naming names, which Hollywood overall was not happy with. Quoting what Orson Welles said about him, he said, "Kazan is a traitor, but he is a very good director." So I think that also places this in complicated territory of, you know, appreciating the art or condemning the person behind the camera. And we've done that before multiple times. Schulberg, the writer, was also in on this. So he named 15 people also. I think what was the most interesting about this is that Arthur Miller was writing the screenplay at first.
Mm-hmm.
The famed author behind The Crucible, all of these notable plays and works. And because Miller wouldn't change the union officials in the story with communists to make this metaphor a bit more literal, they fired him and they replaced him with Schulberg, who Kazan was friends with. So I think that, to me, it's like chilling to think of this happening.
Mm-hmm.
Because the story, like you said, with the description, is just too fitting for what happens. So I think that was the most problematic part to me, is kind of reckoning with that and trying to understand it. I mean, yeah, he ruined lots of filmmakers, actors' careers because of that. And, you know, when he won his honorary at the Oscars, many people did not stand and clap for him, while others did.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you know, that you have to choose a side, but I think that's important to say before we talk about this movie and how really you do think about it after the fact.
Yeah, it's interesting because I left the film, I think, on such a high, because it's just such a beautiful ending when you think about workers' rights and him going against the mob and sticking up for himself and not being afraid. But then when you learn a bit more about Kazan and frankly what feels like narcissism in putting himself a bit into the story, it does make you read it a little bit differently. I think it's still a great cinematic achievement, but the more you learn about the background, the movie, I think the layers become a lot richer. And I'm glad that you mentioned Arthur Miller, because he and Arthur Miller were great friends. And the fact that Kazan testified, that ruined their friendship. It broke their friendship. This movie and his testimony. And I'm so glad you also mentioned the Crucible, because what is the Crucible about? It's a witch hunt. And Arthur Miller wrote the Crucible about this period too. So you have these two different sides, right? You have On the Waterfront as Kazan's response, and you have the Crucible as Miller's response, who believed that what HUAC was doing was a witch hunt for communist and communist sympathizers. So, and it was a direct critique as well on how so many people in Hollywood and in his industry were contributing to this hysteria. So I love thinking about those as kind of dual takes on that. But I also think that, you know, even though, yes, On the Waterfront is Kazan's response, it is, I think, a very powerful story about workers' rights at the end of the day and on real people in this environment who basically have to pay this man to be able to work at all, right? And that's something that you can just, like, feel the corruption all over this screenplay. And you do find yourself rooting for Terry, even though in other cases, he would completely be considered a rat in other media about the mafia, or if we're thinking about HUAC in particular. But here in this story, he doesn't feel that way. And I think that's really from the brilliance of the screenplay, the direction, and the performances. So it's a tough one. It's interesting to think about.
Like, is he our Fredo? Like, I joked in my review the last time I saw this that, like, Brando's characters would hate each other. Like, they would fight to the death.
Oh my God.
In terms
that's
of this
true.
Win versus the Don. And it's like kind of interesting looking at it. Obviously, that came later, but how those characters differ in huge ways.
Throw them both in the ring where they belong. Let them, let them duke it out. But you mentioning Fredo is funny because I also just imagined him as a boxer and that would not go well at all. I think that Sonny is the only one who could probably cut it in the ring of all of the Corleone men.
Very true. Yeah, you really do root for Terry the entire time. And I think his slow realizations along the way are what I needed multiple rewatches on to understand and I guess start to appreciate. Because, I mean, for this movie alone, I see Lee J. Cobb as a villain always. I mean, he is in 12 Angry Men also. It's just like, that's his persona. And seeing him here and how corrupt he is, it's painful. And I think the hardness of Brando's performance as Terry mixed with the tenderness in Edie Doyle, played by Ava Marie Saint, who we also have to mention, another anniversary of sorts. She turned 100 earlier this month. So seeing their relationship deepen and then how she influences Terry in speaking to the crime commission is imperative to the story. And I think why we side with Terry in the end, and we appreciate that he came forward despite how the workers and his friends from the Golden Warriors, who take care of his pigeons with him, desert him. They alienate him.
There are so many bird metaphors in this movie.
Not again.
Everywhere you look, there is a bird metaphor. Pigeons,
Allie,
though.
Allie, where are you?
Especially. But yeah, she's back. If you're a bird, I'm a bird. Thankfully, Kazan and Stuhlberg didn't include that line in On the Waterfront. That was reserved for The Notebook much later. But our themes of our series, they somehow always interconnect, even when we do not plan them.
Yeah. I like it, though. It's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. I love the opening of this movie, though. I think it's so dark right off the bat when Joey dies and his body just crashes down from off that roof when everyone is gathered outside. It's really startling. It also reminds me a little bit of West Side Story, how we feel watching that just outside of those buildings. You get that feel for the neighborhood and you also instantly know, I think, that something is wrong. When I watched this for the first time and on repeat viewings, like, even though I obviously know what happens, you know it's not a suicide. There's foul play involved, and that's going to be the core of the film to come that you're about to watch. But I think it's shot really well, and the sound work is great with that Bernstein score too.
The score, it does remind me of West Side Story from time to time. And I think the noir elements, the really shadowy lighting of this movie remind me of that too. And I think that speaks to some of the more violent elements from that movie. But I do think starting this movie off in a very dark way, I mean, before this, our opening shot is of the shipyard. And this was shot in Hoboken, New Jersey. But if you're paying attention enough, that is the set for the final scene. Mm-hmm. You see that little dock house where Johnny meets and really plans all of his evil doing, but where they fight too. So I like that it's very circular and that mm-hmm. we start there. It introduces us to what we're getting into, but it brings us back in the end, really once we've flipped this story on its head and come back with Terry.
Yeah, I'm so happy that Kazan fought to shoot it in New Jersey, because it would not have the same effect at all in Hollywood. The studio wanted him to shoot it there, and I don't actually think it would be remembered in the same way if it didn't have that authentic feel.
Mm-hmm.
And you, when you're at the docks, or when they're walking by those brownstones, or when Terry and Edie are in the park, like, it just feels like you were in New York or New Jersey, and I love that feeling. And I think that, you know, another huge fan of this movie is, unsurprisingly, Martin Scorsese. He co-directed a film, a documentary that was an ode to Elia Kazan's life, and it was called A Letter to Elia. And in that, he talked about how important it was at the time in 1954 for him as a young person to see people who looked like people that he knew, and to see, you know, their fights and their struggles. And in a way, it showed that filmmakers, to him, cared about people that he was familiar with. They cared about the environments that he grew up in. And I think once you know that about Scorsese, it's impossible, I think, not to link this film to some of Scorsese's work, his interests behind the camera and the types of stories that he tells. It makes perfect sense as connective tissue.
Totally. And there were real workers that acted as extras in this movie. And I think that gives it a more real feel also, that you're there on the docks with them, that you're in the shipyard working, and you start to really understand these places a bit better. When they're on that ship and they end up killing Dugan, I think that is when I really felt the set, the art direction, the design, and the blocking too, because we have different levels. We see Johnny up top looking down. He's kind of orchestrating the shipment of whiskey to fall on him and kill him. And you, during the edit, see the different people looking at each other and kind of agreeing to this happening. And that's definitely another darker moment from the film. And then we get the famous Father Barry monologue after that. But I think coming back a little bit, talking about Terry and Edie and how they meet and their love affair of sorts, this was very melodramatic to me, which, you know, I have trouble with sometimes. Maybe that's why I don't fully connect to this movie. I read certain reviews and just people talking about this movie saying that it's one of the best love scenes ever, which I don't really agree with. But how do you feel about their relationship and, I guess, how those two characters meet? Did you buy into it? How do you feel about the romance part of this film?
I'm not surprised that it didn't work for you. It does work for me. I don't see it as one of the great all-time movie romances, I think especially from the period. But what I do like about it is I think that they're both giving really strong performances. They're probably my two favorites in the movie. I do like Carl Malden as well as Father Barry quite a bit. But what I like about Edie as a character is that she is someone who leaves her hometown and returns, and she's supposed to go back to school because you can tell, like, she has more promise than the people in her environment. And that's how her dad feels about her. And clearly that's what people think of her. But I like how in the movie she makes her own decisions. She is clearly driven by the fact that she knows her brother was killed, and she doesn't want to leave before she finds out what happened to him. And I think that her relationship with Terry is a bit unlikely. And I always like relationships like that in film when the girl is a lot smarter. And, you know, this is a trope we see a lot in film and in literature, but it's like Grease. It's like Danny and Sandy, kind of. Or like, I'm trying to think of another example. There are so many, but they're all embarrassing, obviously. Where you have the like straight-laced, really smart blonde girl.
Uh-huh.
And the bad boy.
Yeah.
I like that. And I think it works here. And I think that she softens him up a little bit. And I always think the reveal of the fact that he had a hand in her brother's death is a really difficult moment in the film, as well as the scene when he breaks into her apartment. I would not be okay with that if I were her, but it's also the 50s. So, and it just is part of the movie. Again, it's a movie. It's not my life. So, but I feel like that's also a staple of Brando, his roles in Kazan's films as well, because we think of how he is in Streetcar with Blanche. Like, he is this really forceful, magnetic, strong presence. And the women next to him are always in opposition to that. I feel like Edie, though, is a much easier character to watch compared to Blanche and what's happening with her in Vivien Leigh's extraordinary performance, of course. But yeah, I buy it. I don't consider it, again, like I said, to be one of the great romances of cinema. I don't think it really has enough time to breathe, but I find myself really interested in it, less so though than the rest of the film. It's important to the story, but I care more, I think, about what's happening with the union and with the mob and that drama compared to this relationship.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense. I do like Ava's acting and her tenderness, how soft she is and forgiving of Terry way before she knows that Terry did have a hand in Joey's death. But I like really her quote when they meet on the water. She says, when she's talking about troubled kids growing up, she says, that's what makes people mean and difficult. They don't care enough about them. So I think throughout the film, we see her tending to other characters. She's always around her dad. She's at the shipyard at one scene, and the father is like, how could you expose her to these elements to see how these men act around each other? And this is when they're fighting over the coins to work for the day, and a brawl breaks out, and she tries to go for the coin for her father. So I think seeing those two worlds collide is what adds to the drama in the film in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
I do agree that the darker elements, the more thrilling ones, are of either the drama between Terry and his brother Charlie. That's a really important scene. The way the father inserts himself into this, you know, he says that if Dugan will stick up for the other people who can't speak, then he will. And then he really becomes condemned. I think talking about his scene in particular, his monologue in the cargo hold, I really liked. I mean, he makes multiple references to Jesus and being condemned and crucified, and that these people who have died have been crucified. And at the end of it, he stands on that dolly and rises out of the boat. I feel like Christ on a crane. So it's a very symbolic moment. And I think with Johnny watching this happen, it's interesting to see this idea of religion and corruption collide in this way. Because I wasn't sure if, you know, Johnny would end up going after the father or how that would play out. But it creates some really complex ideas and commentaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you about this scene in particular, because I know you said that Father Barry was either your favorite character or that Carl Malden gave the best performance in the movie. He also famously won an Oscar for supporting actor for A Streetcar Named Desire, so another key collaborator of Kazan. But I think that his role is a really important one, and I also like that he and Edie serve similar functions in some scenes, where we'll see them kind of off to the side as this, you know, representation of goodness, or mm-hmm. removed from the action a little bit, but also still putting themselves into it, right? As people who I think Terry can rely on. I also want to talk about the most famous scene from the movie, which is the taxi scene. This quote, so if you're thinking about On the Waterfront, guaranteed you are thinking about, you don't understand, I could have had class, I could have been a contender, I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. This is number 3 on AFI's list of movie quotes on the 100 years list. So even if you haven't seen On the Waterfront, I am sure you've heard this quote, or you've seen it in trivia or something like that. But I think that this scene is one of the best in the movie. It's a very long scene. There's a lot of dialogue to it. It makes me think actually of watching a play, but it feels like its own little story, really, within the rest of the film. And it really showcases how incredible Brando's performance is to me, because he, in his conversation with Charlie, Rod Steiger's character, I think you get to see the pain in Terry as a character and Brando's realism. It's not, to me, over the top at all. It feels very true to this character, and that's not something I think that we're always used to seeing in the 50s.
Yeah, this scene, it's surprising because it comes so late in the movie, and it's really one of the only times we see Rod Steiger as Charlie, but it's the only time we see Terry and Charlie together. So I think that puts a lot of weight on this conversation and its meaning relative to the entire film. So when you do look at it, they talk about Terry's boxing career and his potential, that he could have been somebody, but at one of the fights, the brother, Charlie, basically told him to throw it for the other guy who became a really famous fighter. So I think that tells you about their relationship as brothers. It says so much about that. And that's really all we need to know about how they treat each other, Charlie's direction in life, and how he works for Johnny. He's like his right-hand man. And then Terry, how he fell into his position too in this world. And it really comes down to, I think, the guilt that they both feel, mm-hmm. but that he places on Charlie. Because Charlie, in the end, I mean, he has a gun on Terry. Like, pulling a gun on your brother just sounds like the most dire act. And he's ready to take him into Johnny. And then mm-hmm. once Terry says this story, he relents. He says, take this gun, you're going to need it, because he's fighting for the right cause.
Mm-hmm.
And once Terry gets out, obviously the driver is in on this, and he takes him and Charlie is killed. So we have another casualty in this war on corruption. And this is really when the tides turn for Terry, that he's mm-hmm. ready to fight. He goes to find Johnny, and then he goes and sees Edie. So it's a very powerful moment in the film, and it's really the turning point. So I understand now why it's so important, why the lines are held in such high regard, but it's kind of surprising because it's such an understated moment. He's not screaming, I could have been a contender. It's just, it's so soft, and like he has no more strength. Like he's done. He can't fight anymore. And I think that's the most emotional, raw element that you just really feel for Terry.
I agree. It's so painful and vulnerable. It's a confession scene. Like, we're not in a church, we're in a taxi, but it feels like a confession. And it also connects what Charlie has done in the mob with Terry's boxing career. And it's this very, I think, painful moment between the two brothers. And again, that realization that Charlie has when he gives Terry the gun of, you know, here they come, you're going to need it. And the realization that Terry has that he knows what he needs to do now. I think that's what makes it so powerful. And that's why it works so well that it comes later in the film when it does. Right before we head into this ending, which I really do love. I think that the finale at the waterfront is pretty perfect in the way that it's executed and filmed, and take the Kazan stuff out of it. I always feel very moved when I'm watching it. And when Terry has decided to stick up for himself and the other workers, and he's beaten to a pulp, but he gets up and walks anyway. And again, the filming of that, of him walking and of everyone else really sticking it to Johnny Friendly. And then when that gate goes down and we get the end, I think it's perfection.
And it's a very short finale. It's less than 10 minutes, maybe even 5 minutes. But Terry comes in ready to fight and he starts fighting Johnny. And I was like, are you sure he was a boxer? Because he is not knocking him out immediately.
Yeah.
And then you hear the other workers who are watching really, I mean, from a distance because they're fighting on the water. But at first, they're not for Terry. They're still on Johnny's side because they want to get paid and they understand the system. But once they start fighting, they start realizing what Terry is doing for the betterment of them. And they're like, oh, he's still got his fighting skills. And then Johnny, he bows out. He tells his fellow mobsters to come fight him instead. So now it's like 10 to 1 instead of Terry and Johnny fighting. So I think that just furthers that idea of corruption in this world. But yeah, once he comes out, I really love in this moment the out of focus camera of the fact that this is from Terry's POV and he can't see because he's been beaten to a pulp, but he keeps walking. And with each step, he's faltering left and right, but he makes it. And I think that's why it's so powerful, is you feel his strength returning and that the workers have joined him in fighting Johnny. To a point of almost comic relief when Johnny is pushed into the water. And then in the end, he's like, what are you doing? I know all of you. You know, you're never going to get paid again or work again, but it's too many against one at this point.
Do you want to hear a really interesting reading on the ending from our dear Martin Scorsese?
Oh, yeah.
So I thought this was fascinating. This is from his documentary, but he believes the ending to be a fantasy. He says, people like Terry Molloy wind up dead. And this was a convention of the film that he just accepted as a work of fantasy. He didn't believe that this could happen to someone like Terry Molloy or to these longshoremen who are in the film who live in Hoboken. He feels like that's not the outcome for people like this. So this, it's a fantasy. And that he walks away from it thinking, it's just a movie.
Interesting. I mean, I understand that too. It's what you want to see happening of him coming out alive and good triumphing over evil. But I can see that too, that in these instances, especially back in the day,
well,
that's sad.
I know, right?
Rough.
Yeah, it's a very Scorsese read on it. I like it as an alternate, as another perspective on it. So let's talk a bit about the Oscars. So we already mentioned that this film won 8 Oscars and was nominated for 4 others. Do you think that anything was snubbed? I don't think there's really anything else. Like, looking through it,
what are our options?
I'm like, truly, what didn't get nominated? We don't have costume design, black and white. That's maybe the only other option here. The costume design nominations that year are great. Edith Head won for Sabrina, and in what is an incredibly inspired nomination, The Earrings of Madame Do was nominated, which is, as you know, one of my all-time favorite movies. I love that that's here. But yeah, that's the only one I can really think of.
That is truly it, which is so astonishing.
Yeah.
I was surprised even editing one at this point.
I know, right?
Of all the things, I understand cinematography, it's beautiful. But editing, if we're looking at, you know, this was the era of the disaster films, even before the 70s, Lord. Of those nominees, we have 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, The Caine Mutiny, which I believe was number 2 at the box office for the year. Mm-hmm. And then The High and the Mighty, which won other awards, and Seven Bridges for Seven Brothers. So I'm kind of surprised one of those other ones didn't win. But again, I think the support for this movie just really showed with its wins.
Yeah.
Not in supporting actor, which is surprising because this is the first time in Oscar history that you have three people nominated in the same category and the fourth best picture winner to have five acting noms total. But is it a little bit of vote splitting? Maybe, especially with three.
It's possible.
And I think the story behind Edmund O'Brien winning for The Barefoot Contessa, he couldn't have billing over Bogart in that movie, but he was very happy to have won. But yeah, I think it did very well for itself. I honestly think it's a little higher than I would have done. But again, I understand its importance and why it had so many.
Yeah, I think let's maybe talk through some of the categories just in, did the Academy get it right? I think in particular with picture. So this won Best Picture. The other nominees were The Caine Mutiny, The Country Girl, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, and Three Coins in the Fountain. Do you think the Academy got it right?
Absolutely. I think this is a no-brainer. And throughout the season, it had been winning everything. How do you feel about the other nominees?
So that's the thing. If I'm just looking at the nominees, the Academy absolutely got it right.
Yeah.
But if we're putting in my favorite movie of 1954, which is Rear Window, the Academy did not get it right. But that's not here. So I think of the five, it absolutely should be the Best Picture winner. It makes a lot of sense. These are not movies that I return to. But On the Waterfront, I think, is a classic. It holds up for a reason and is a great Best Picture winner. I think director is even more interesting because Elia Kazan won for On the Waterfront, but we also had George Seton for The Country Girl, William A. Wellman for The High and the Mighty, Alfred Hitchcock for Rear Window, and Billy Wilder for Sabrina. We covered Sabrina previously, and we covered Rear Window previously. Mm-hmm. So do you think they got it right here in director? I'm going to say no. I would have given it to Hitchcock because he's here. And that movie, I think, is pretty astonishing in terms of direction and just a genius concept and execution.
Mm-hmm. This is tough. I also really love Rear Window. Would I have loved to have seen it win one of these big awards? Absolutely. Was it going to? Maybe not. But the other thing to consider is that with HUAC, this happened 2 years prior. So I feel like it's still fresh in their brain. So I am kind of surprised, or maybe I wonder if it was closer than just it winning picture and director together. So obviously we don't have any lead actress nominees here. They did purposefully put Ava Marie Saint in supporting so that she wouldn't be in the Grace Kelly, Judy Garland, even maybe Audrey Hepburn battle that category had. But I think it's interesting, and my question for you is, so Grace Kelly won for The Country Girl. She turned down On the Waterfront in Ava Marie Saint's casting to be in Rear Window. So do you feel like Grace Kelly as Edie would have worked, period, or maybe better than Ava Marie Saint?
Well, the interesting thing here is actually, if she was able to do both, would she have a Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress Oscar in the same year? Which I think
fascinating. Yeah.
I think either yes, or she just gets supporting and Best Actress goes to someone else, which is also interesting because for a lot of people, Judy Garland losing for A Star Is Born is one of the great Oscar sadnesses in history. So that's interesting to think about. Wow. I didn't know that about On the Waterfront and Rear Window. I prefer Grace Kelly's performance in Rear Window. I would have put her in here for that instead. I think she would have been great in On the Waterfront. I feel like she would have been really good. I think she's so, so beautiful, though, that like I feel like she always looks like a princess. And not that Eva Marie Saint isn't. She's also stunning. But there's something about Grace Kelly's beauty that is very arresting. And I feel like seeing her opposite Marlon Brando in that role, I don't know how that would make me feel about the romance. I think it would be a lot. I love her opposite Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window, though. That is so good, because when he just doesn't pay attention to her and she's wearing those beautiful gowns, you want to shake him. You want to break his other leg. You're like, what are you doing?
It works because she's supposed to be so stunning, but I think in a similar way that you question it there, you would have questioned her living in a New Jersey apartment where Marlon Brando can kick down a locked door.
Yeah.
So
it's true.
Maybe it does work.
She's quite literally a princess too. Like that was her destiny. That's who she became. But I think she's a great actress. I think she would have been good in the role, but I do like Eva Marie Saint here, and I do like how it ended up in film history.
Mm-hmm. How do you think today's Academy would receive this movie?
I think pretty well. I don't know about 12 nominations total with 8 wins, but I think it would do really well. I think they would still really like it. I think they would still attach themselves to its pro-worker, pro-union message. I think the performances are so strong, the direction. It's a very beautiful film. I think they would like it. Maybe, I mean, as much as they could today, I think. What about you?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think it has all of those components that would still grip the Academy today. And again, has all of the elements to do so. From a technical standpoint, from an acting standpoint, everything either above or below the line. And I think that's one that would definitely do well today.
And if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
See, some of those feelings come in. It's like,
yeah,
because of what Schulberg did with HUAC, do I want to award it to him for screenplay? I know that's bad, but I think I am going to give it to him for screenplay and story, because it's just so dense and rich, and maybe not in a way that Chinatown is, but I think it works similarly here, and that you really have to pay attention. You learn so much with every line. And like we talked about, there are very notable lines that stick with you. Also from that conversation we didn't mention, but he could have had a one-way ticket to Palookaville, I think is also one of the funniest things that he says there. But yeah, I think it's pitch perfect. But I think the way it balances the romance and the drama, it does it so, so fluidly. What Oscar would you give it?
I would absolutely give Marlon Brando Best Actor. I think I agree that this is one of the great on-screen performances that we have. One of the all-time Best Actor wins. And just reading about what other actors think of him when they watch this movie, I tend to agree. You really can't take your eyes off of him when he's on screen. He has that mesmerizing quality, and he's doing something that is so different from his peers and from people at the time. And when you're watching him, he just feels like one of those all-time great screen presences and actors. You really get it. And I'm so happy that this didn't go to Frank Sinatra, because Frank Sinatra really wanted it, but Kazan wanted Brando instead.
Wow.
So that's one of the all-time what-ifs, I think, in film history, because this performance inspired so many people. But I really do think, like, this, when you think of the all-time great method performances, this is it. So I'm going to go Brando.
Also a great pick. Well, that was our episode on the Best Picture winner on the waterfront. I'm very glad we did talk about it, and I think it's one that you need to have like a pretty in-depth conversation about. So I hope you enjoyed it too. Next time on Oscar Wilde, we'll be doing a mailbag. So submit all your questions, if it's about fall festival season, if it's about anything from this year, or just any movie questions you have in general, we'll answer it.
Yeah, anything. Favorite movie, candy, favorite movie poster, you know, all sorts of things. Where do you sit in the theater? All of that good stuff. We will answer it. And yeah, I'm excited. We haven't done a mailbag in a while, so this will be a nice treat before we head into the craziness of fall festival season. But thank you all so much for listening. If you like our show, please feel free to rate, review, and follow. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Oscar Wilde Pod. And if you really like our show, you can subscribe at patreon.com/OscarWilde for bonus content.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.